Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you all with us for today's show. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and our regular Wednesday guest on this show. I'm glad that you could be here today.
Glad to be here.
Always glad when you can take time from your busy schedule. Anybody who writes as many pieces a day as you do, it's a pleasure to get you in the studio.
I just got back from the dentist. I got a clean checkup.
Well, congratulations. Loretta Lepore. She's the former communications director for Governor Sonny Perdue, now, of course, our agriculture secretary. And was at one point a candidate, a Republican candidate. You've given up that part of your life, though.
Yes, I have.
Running for legislature or county commission or anything like that.
Yes, I have.
And now working doing government relations work, you've been spending time down at the Capitol.
I have. I was there this morning.
Okay.
Not much different than going to the dentist.
Amen.
And we're joined by Beth Shapiro. You know, Beth is now, in an official way, retired. She's a former pollster, did a lot of work for Democratic candidates and consultant, also did a lot of work for corporate interests. And you haven't really retired. You're still got your hands in politics.
You know, it's this defective gene I've got that just keeps drawing me to political campaigns. And if we're on the medical conversation, I can brag about the new crown that I received yesterday.
Oh, All right. I see the theme developing here. So before we get into the news today, I do want to remind everybody, we're heading down to Savannah tomorrow morning. We're going to get in our cars. Tom Faust, Olivia Rheingold, and I are going to be heading down there. We're going to be recording Political Rewind in front of a live audience tomorrow night at the Savannah Jewish Education Center. It's the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia invited us down, and we were excited that they did. And if you want to be in the audience, I think you can still get in. There's no charge, but you go to just go to gpb.org/community. We do need you to register if you want to come to the event. We start, I think, at 7 o'clock. But the other thing that I have forgotten to tell you over and over again is that you can watch the show live on the GPB Facebook page if you want to tomorrow night. And then we'll broadcast the show in our usual time Friday at 2, and we'll have a lot of news out of Savannah that has statewide implications. Two former Savannah State Senators, Al Scott and Eric Johnson, will be on the panel, along with Jim Galloway and me, and the editor of the Savannah Morning News will be there as well, Susan Catron. So it ought to be a really good session, and if you can be there with us, we'd love to have you down there. With that said, excuse me, let me give you a quick headline. The Majority Leader Mitch McConnell took to the floor of the U.S. Senate about a half hour ago, announced that he has reached a deal with Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats, setting up a two-year budget that would include raising spending levels for defense and a number of non-defense programs like disaster relief and other programs. And so they're excited, you know, there's a deadline tomorrow night to reach an agreement, or else a government runs out of money. It's now up to the House, it appears, and as of this morning, Nancy Pelosi was pushing back hard, saying Democrats aren't going to support this plan unless the Speaker, Paul Ryan, agrees firmly and makes an unequivocally firm deal to bring up an immigration bill next week. I don't think Ryan's about to do that, but Democrats can't hold it back in the House.
Yeah, this is a really tough issue because, of course, Mitch McConnell in the Senate had agreed to having that debate, that open floor debate about the DACA issue. But Paul Ryan never did. And, you know, Paul Ryan will ostensibly need some Democratic support to get this budget plan passed because you'd have to imagine some fiscal conservatives would push back against it because it does grow the federal deficit even more, especially on top of the $1.5 trillion tax plan that already ballooned the deficit. But it's not clear how many Democrats will stick with Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
If Republicans can cleave over a few, they might not need her support.
All right, we're going to talk about that a little later in the show and as part of the conversation about immigration. So let's table that for now, but I did want you to hear that news. And also, the Washington Post has a breaking story. that is of interest given the times we're living in. White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter, who is a top aide to President Trump, has resigned following allegations of emotional and physical abuse from two of his wives. If you want to learn more about that story, it's on the Washington Post website. Porter says these outrageous allegations are simply false. That's a quote. And that he has been transparent and truthful about these, he calls them vile claims, but he says he's going to resign because he doesn't want to distract from the president's agenda. This sort of thing just seems going and going and going, Loretta.
Well, it is going, and it's going in all aspects of our society, really. You know, more and more of these types of situations are coming to the fore, and I don't think that it's going to end anytime soon. I mean, there was a story this morning about Silicon Valley, and there's a whole new book out written by a reporter on, you know, how outdated Silicon Valley is and how they've missed the boat on having female talent grow their industry. And so I think we're just going to continue to see more and more of this become much more transparent at all levels of government and in all industry sectors, business sectors.
It's kind of ironic that the person for whom this guy works is somebody who doesn't have the best track record of how he treats women in general, his wives in particular, particularly given the recent allegation about the affair with a porn star. And I think Loretta's exactly right about the times we're in, but still, we're as a country, we're putting up with what the president, how the president behaves, but the staffer has to go.
All right. So that's just a little bit to update everybody on breaking news as of this hour. Greg Bluestein, let's talk about an interesting change of what seems to be a change of heart by Governor Deal surrounding how the new tax law passed by Republicans at the end of last year might affect Georgia citizens. We know for a variety of reasons, among them, some deductions have been eliminated. More people are likely to file a standard return than before, partly because of deductions. We know that, ironically, while a great many people's federal taxes may come down, on the other hand, it's quite possible that a lot of Georgians are going to pay more in state income tax. And so the state has to figure out what to do with, they're not quite sure, but it's potentially a $3.5 billion windfall in taxes for the state over 5 years. And this is not exactly the year you want people to believe that essentially you've given them a tax hike, even though you haven't voted on it yourself.
Yeah, and this is very, very tricky because it looks like some estimates say as much as $900 million windfall just in this next fiscal year for Georgia. At the same time, the governor's maybe one of his proudest achievements is building the short-term reserve fund, about $2.5 billion. He's tried to hold the line on deeper tax cuts, saying that we have to be very careful about how we spend public money. And there's a lot of lawmakers who aren't sure whether or not that $900 million will actually be produced and actually show up. So there's a debate going on, especially with it being election year. Every Republican on the ballot wants to go on the campaign trail and say they passed it.
Yeah, and I should explain, when I said an apparent change of heart by the governor, you really kind of alluded to it. The governor has said, let's stay away from anything dealing with reform of the tax code or, let's stay away from, we don't know what the windfall is really going to be, let's stay. And all of a sudden now he's changing his tune a bit, Loretta, saying, well, maybe we are going to have to look at this.
Yes, I think so. I think Greg's point, too, about it being a political year, you will have people filing their taxes on April 15th. They'll be going to the polls about 6 weeks later. So people will know what they're paying at the state level. It is premature in a lot of respects to also to Greg's point that we don't know what the windfall will actually be. Plus, we don't really know what the budget situation is going to be. And that's always a tricky widget for states to try to balance their budget, which they're constitutionally bound to do, when you still have indecision at the federal level. So we know where we are with that, as you mentioned at the top of the show, where we've had these continuing resolutions. We've had, we now have a potential compromise, maybe a compromise. We'll see where that all ends up. So it's still very much a juggling act for appropriators and for the governor.
Quote, Beth, from the governor, we don't have any specifics As soon as we get a little more comfortable as to the numbers we can rely on, it's our hope we can work with the leadership of the General Assembly on a separate bill.
And I, certainly, I, we should all hope that's the case. I do think that one of Governor Deal's defining traits is his moderation, his even temperament, and his unwillingness to jump out there and do things like support tax cuts just because we think we're going to have a windfall. So I applaud his leadership on this, and perhaps I don't know, maybe this becomes a special session at some point, that it's nothing that gets decided now, between now and the end of the session. But again, special session is tricky because you've got elections coming up. You've got primaries coming up.
And you've got Amazon in a special session, too. So.
Right. Well, on the upside is usually if a governor calls a special session, it can be dedicated to one singular issue.
Yes.
So there's a focus. You don't have a lot of distraction and other potential things that could happen.
In fact, what you're saying is exactly right. It is the governor who decides what the special session will take on, whether it's one issue like an Amazon or whether it's four or five issues that the governor decides
sets
to take
out.
On,
right.
Correct?
Right.
Okay.
But I can imagine there might not be anything else that Casey Cagle wants to do more this session than pass some sort of tax break that he can claim partial credit for at least and then go out the campaign trail for governor.
Well, the other tricky thing is in the tax bill, the federal tax bill, the individual piece of this is for a number of years, 8 years, correct? Am I correct in that, if I recall correctly? And so, you know, whatever the state does has to take into account that this is not potentially a permanent change. So how do you address that time increment as well?
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how they handle it because, as you point out, Greg, we do have Casey Cagle running for governor, the lieutenant governor, president of the Senate, really wants to do something in this. Okay, so if you don't mind, this is to some extent trivial, but on the other hand, I find it interesting. Windfall. We talk about a windfall to the state of billions of dollars. That's a dissonant note to me, Beth, because windfalls are supposed to accrue to us, the people, not to the state.
Well, it is in this case accruing to the state.
That's right.
And you know,
it just sounds so pretty that way. There.
Yes, we're just going to reach out and grab the money from our taxpayers that's coming in. You know, it's not as if there's a shortage of big things that the legislature is talking about doing right now. Not least of which is rural broadband and measures to help the economy of rural Georgia. I just happened to have gone to a funeral down in Bartow, Georgia, a couple of weeks ago. And once you get off of I-20 and start driving southeast from there, it's pretty desolate territory. And we went through downtowns of places like Sparta that are essentially closed up. And it's hard to drive through areas like that and not feel that there's something more that we can be doing to help strengthen the economic health of those areas.
Yeah, Greg, the other thing that is being discussed as they look at what to do with that $3.5 billion that they project over the next few years is the exemption on airplane fuel. That's something Delta Airlines, of course, has wanted since at least 2015 when the bill failed.
Yeah. And that's part of the governor's package this year, and he announced that yesterday. He made it very clear that is one of his top priorities for this session, which is reinstating that exemption on jet fuel tax. But Delta and its representatives have gone all over the state capitol and said, this is not a Delta tax break. This is an airline fuel tax break.
All right, so let me ask about that.
Tell it to the Clayton County government that's going to lose that tax
right.
income.
Clayton County is very upset about this because it's an $18 million or more
hit. It's a huge hit.
Which is a big hit to
a
county
huge
like
hit.
Clayton.
But here's the other thing. To be fair-minded, Loretta, I understand why Delta would try to make that argument that this will help attract more airlines to Hartsfield-Jackson International, except Delta doesn't want any new airlines to get gates at Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport.
Well, I don't know that that would be Delta's. I don't see those as messaging points, obviously, from Delta. But I think that, you know, as the governor said in his remarks when he was talking about this, was that it would increase the number of flights, not necessarily the number of airlines coming into Georgia, to your point that we don't have capacity and gates for more airlines to come in here, but that it would be more flights coming in and out of it and, you know, building Atlanta as reputation as a gateway, an international gateway for business.
Delta kind of got off caught off guard in 2015 when this tax break was written off the books, and that was at, of course, when Georgia was trying to raise $1 billion in new revenue yearly to improve the transportation infrastructure. And Delta was seen as one of these big juicy targets, and there weren't a lot of lawmakers who had that much empathy for Delta because it was, you know, raking in giant profits every quarter.
And it was also part of the effort to try to keep Georgia from passing a so-called religious freedom bill.
Yeah,
we'll come back to the adoption bill that we're going to talk about later.
And I'm glad you mentioned
that. These issues don't go away.
And it's good to remember things like that, because what happened was when Delta became one of the corporations that publicly argued against the religious liberty bill, suddenly State Representative Earl Earhart, a hard-nosed conservative, longest-serving member of the state legislature.
Republican member of the state.
Suddenly said, you know, I think we ought to revisit this fuel tax break for Delta.
And because it got known as the Delta tax break, it didn't engender that much sympathy from lawmakers. So this year, they're trying to brand it as the airline fuel tax break that would help Southwest and any other airlines that might want to, store and refine some of its fuel in Georgia. Already it's got the governor's approval, but you know what else helps? The Delta hired David Werner, the governor's former chief executive counsel, as its top lobbyist. So this is his main goal this session.
All right. Let's take up one more issue before we take a break. And I want to bring it up in part because we've had some listeners who have either tweeted or sent emails asking us to talk just a bit about this. None of us lives in Cobb County, so I just throw this out in general. Cobb County is now facing a $30 to $55 million shortfall in their 2019 budget, and it appears that they may have to close up to 8 libraries or consolidate libraries. They're going to have to eliminate part-time library positions, and there's a lot of concern that this all comes back to how much money Cobb was willing to invest in a baseball field, Loretta. And you can understand why some people, you know, sort of like literate people, might be concerned about this.
Well, I think it's a huge problem, right? And so that the whole stadium was an effort, you know, to bring the Braves to Cobb County, yet not raise taxes in the county. And you had a lot of public outcry at the time. You had certain members of the county commission that were tone deaf to some of that and didn't understand the repercussions that would come. We've seen people have lost office simply because of those decisions.
County Chair Tim Lee lost his bid for re-election because of it.
Right, and so now the county is having to reconcile. They're having to, and this is a different place for Cobb County, which has traditionally not had these types of issues. So how they manage through this is going to be very interesting and new to them, so new to the residents of Cobb County.
You know, insanity is described as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
I feel that way 3 times a week when I open the mic and start this show.
And what different result are you expecting today? But if you look just at the Atlanta metro area, forget other cities around the country, we have instance after instance of professional sports teams dangling the alleged excitement and reputational benefits of having a venue in their community. And we have elected officials at the highest levels, whether it's Commissioner Lee or former Commissioner Lee or former Mayor Reed, who open the public's pocketbooks and give them redone Phillips Arenas or Mercedes-Benz Stadiums or the Gwinnett Braves home. Now we've got discussions in College Park. The Hawks are are dangling a new training center there.
A big lawsuit ongoing over that right now.
And yet, as often as not, with the new stadium and the Phillips Arena being perhaps the two exceptions, as often as not, these are money losers for the public, and they're not the net benefits that everybody expects, yet we keep doing it. And now it's, as somebody who actually was a library science major during one part of her college career and who still loves public libraries, it's just really sad to see that we have to potentially close libraries so that we can have a big trophy stadium at the intersection of I-75 and I-285.
And remember, these are relatively plush economic times. I mean, we're not, you know, our unemployment rate is low. Our economy is growing, if not at the pace that could be growing. But imagine if this were a tougher economic time, how many more cutbacks they'd have to make because of these decisions.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show in. When we come back, front page of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution this morning, big story, Atlanta, eighth worst traffic congestion, not in the United States, in the world. We'll talk about that and what that might mean for advancing a transit bill at the Capitol this session. Let's take a quick break. This is Political Rewind.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Beth Shapiro, Loretta Lepore, and Greg Bluestein are with me today on Political Rewind. Loretta, you do a lot of transportation. You've over the years been really involved in transportation issues at the Capitol, so I'll lead off with you on this. An organization that looks at these issues of traffic and congestion, that sort of thing, did say that Atlanta is the eighth worst in the world. It's right up there with London. It's right up there with Los Angeles. I think Los Angeles remains number one on that list. And it happens at a time when we now have Brandon Beach, who's been an advocate for transit, introducing again this session a bill that he believes would really help Metro Atlanta, especially get some transit going. Talk about it with us.
So his bill does two things. One, it creates a regional entity. So, you know, when we talk about one of the biggest obstacles to transit throughout the metro region has been cooperation amongst the various entities. We've seen that through various T-SPLOS efforts over the years. And so what his bill would do is, one, put MARTA in charge of operations of any transit. So that would be a clear delineator where there have been questions about that before. And then there would be a governing structure, which has been absent in the metro region, to govern whatever transit and state funding potentially that would be put into transit in the region. And the governor, ironically, has a role on this new transit board. And that would include GRETA, and GRETA would play a big role.
GRETA being the Georgia Regional Transit Authority. Yeah.
I apologize. Yeah, and they,
no, that's
and
right.
they also oversee they oversee all of the bus transit right now, yeah. So in the region. And so and then I think the second part of that is where I don't have great clarity on this yet, but is that there would be an increase, potentially the ability for counties to add a 1 cent sales tax to go to additional transit. I think that's kind of been up for some debate right now. You hear a little bit of conversation going on about that, simply because you see some more conservative legislators saying, okay, let's find more innovative ways to address transit without having to put that to the voters again. You know, Fulton and the city of Atlanta both had referenda in 2016. Taxes went up, plus you have Fulton in a cab already paying for MARTA and other. There's an argument among some of those members of those delegations that others in the metro region need to start contributing now if it's going to be a metro-wide transit system. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of discussion about that this year. A bill just came out this week, mm-hmm. to the best of my knowledge. And I think there's going to be a bill coming out in the House as well.
Yeah, I mean, and the big differences between those bills are how the divisions, the transit units are divided. The House version, it looks like it's North Fulton County split in three different ways. The Senate version would be each county would be partitioned in the same way by a county-level unit. But I think the biggest thing that's going on, the biggest trend, is that we've had decades of gridlock over transit debate in the Georgia legislature. And in 2015, we first saw the biggest thaw in that when the lawmakers passed this billion-dollar annual infrastructure funding plan. They also, for the first time, gave $75 million, I think it was $75 million, one time, but to transit, and that sort of jump-started the debate. Now we have voters have approved transit expansions in Atlanta, Clayton County, and others are on the drawing board for Gwinnett and Fulton counties right now.
And the reports are that Clayton County has really taken advantage of having a MARTA expansion down there and that it's been very popular, which is a good, I suppose, if you're in an outlying county that hasn't adopted mm-hmm. it yet, you're going to look to Clayton and say, look, the people of that county have been glad they have this now.
And the biggest debate the lawmakers have about transit is whether or not to allot annual dedicated funding to MARTA or other transit. And these two packages of legislation that we just heard about could pave the way for that.
Beth, isn't it interesting that 5, 6, 7 years ago, there's no way that a Republican like Brandon Beach would have ever introduced a measure that says, yes, but if you can expand, but you've got to let MARTA run the system. It's a real tribute to the way in which MARTA has turned around its operation and actually now is thought of as doing a good job in overseeing transit infrastructure and day-in and day-out operations and budgets, that sort of thing.
Well, they had a pretty powerful leadership combination in Robbie Ash as chair of the board and Keith Parker as the general manager. And I think that went a long way, and vastly improved operations went a long way to bringing people on board. I do think that the elected officials are catching up with their voters. We did polling. I've seen polling over the years in Cobb, North Fulton, Gwinnett, where the voters want some alternatives to getting in their cars. And I think that, coupled with the prospect of getting Amazon, and I think nothing has focused the attention particularly of the Northwest Corridor, the Cobb County leaders, as the fact that if Amazon has succumbed, they really aren't in the picture, in the hunt, in terms of a location, because they don't have any type of public transportation or any type of any extensive public transportation.
Well, I think there's also a mind shift going on in transportation today, those involved with it, that, you know, we used to have kind of this idea that if we were going to expand transit, it was going to be heavy rail, right? And it took a while to just get past that. So, you know, transit can be bus service. When you look at Clayton, there's this bus service. It was success. And you look at North Fulton, they're advocating for bus service. They're advocating for managed lanes. They're advocating for things of those sort, which are faster to bring to fruition, that allow for more immediate relief, and something that their constituencies are in favor of. Heavy rail is almost something of a bygone era, and you factor in now autonomous vehicles, which I know that MARTA is taking into account as part of, you know, how did they over time, you know, incorporate autonomous vehicles into their fleet of managed options. So, you know, there's a little bit of a mind shift, I think, going on, and people are becoming more educated as to what transit is and how transit can work.
So it's not just Amazon. Excuse me. Let me interrupt you, Mr. Moderator.
Quite all right.
It's not just Amazon. It's if you look at the development patterns just over the past 5 years, Midtown is booming, mm-hmm. Buckhead is booming, the Perimeter Center area is booming, and it's because companies are looking to relocate where there's convenient. In these cases, MARTA rail, but it's economic development of the future. You've got to be able to provide a way for people to get to and from work easily.
The State Farm complex in Dunwoody has become a favorite Republican talking point. That is a conservative leaning area that is exploding because State Farm decided to build its regional headquarters right on the MARTA line. And you mentioned Cobb County earlier, but look at Gwinnett County. They lost two Fortune 500 companies to Midtown and to Sandy Springs because they were harder to access.
All right, so we're going to move on, but I will say this. Whether it's the transit bill, or if I had a bill that I needed to get through the General Assembly or wanted to, Brandon Beach would be my, he is relentless. He's been focused on this issue, and whether you agree with him or not, you got to give him credit for not ever surrendering the field on this issue.
And remember, he faced a very bitter primary opponent in 2016 who was going after him for his support of these issues, and he ended up winning resoundingly.
All right, let's move to the governor's race for a little while. There's some interesting developments there. This morning, our friend Brian Robinson, who is now working for Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle's gubernatorial campaign, which is why Brian's on hiatus right now. He's on the payroll, and we don't want to talk about the governor's race. We love him, but he understands that. But he sent out an interesting tweet, I thought. Greg, he tweeted that Hunter Hill and Clay Tippins, two Republicans running for governor, who have both now put out commercials, both of those commercials attack Casey Cagle. And Brian's point is that that means they think that Cagle can win this thing without a runoff.
Right.
If they didn't, they'd be attacking whoever they think they have to beat to get into the runoff. That's an interesting way to spin this.
Yeah, I guess these figures, they must be doing something right. And not only do those commercials attack Casey Cagle, they also included lookalikes of Casey Cagle.
Yeah.
Both pretty decent lookalikes.
So we played the other day the Clay Tippins spot. He spent $250,000 to put it on during a local break in the Super Bowl. I don't have the figures on what Hunter Hill spent.
$375,000.
Really? So he bought a lot of points at this stage in the race. So he's going to be out there pretty well on this. So Hunter Hill has a spot. You're not obviously see the visuals, but it takes advantage of the fact that he has a strong military background. And so it shows Hunter Hill, he was a Marine? No.
No.
Army Ranger.
Wearing a kind of a muscle T-shirt, doing an obstacle course with a Casey Cagle lookalike and what I presume is sort of a Brian Kemp lookalike.
It was, because I
But the
I
Cagle lookalike
detail.
Appears much more,
that's
is more
exactly
prominent of the
right.
two.
And so we'll listen to what the commercial says. Keep the visuals in mind.
I'm Hunter Hill, Army Ranger. Unlike these guys, I'm not a career politician. Georgia's next governor will face many obstacles. That's why we need true conservative leadership that delivers results. As governor, I'll stop sanctuary cities and eliminate the state income tax. During three combat tours, I defended our Constitution, and now I'm ready to serve again. These guys, they'll never make it out of the swamp.
Clay Tippins. Hunter Hill, you know, does the obstacle course with ease. Not so the lookalikes. They're falling far behind. What do you think, Loretta? You know, you've done a lot of consulting style work. You too, Beth. Are they right to be shooting a Casey Cagle at this point? Do we think Casey Cagle could really win this thing without a runoff?
Well, I think that there is common thought that Casey is the front runner at this point in time.
Sure.
I don't think that there is consensus that he will win outright.
All right, but then with that in mind, do you want to spend your money attacking him instead of positioning yourself for the runoff against
I think that these candidates do think they're positioning themselves for the runoff.
All right.
That if they can get into the runoff, then they would have a good shot at Casey, at that point in that stage of the game, going head to head.
Beth, what would you do?
I think attacking Cagle makes sense.
Okay.
It's kind of hard to know what kind of legs the Brian Kemp campaign will get. Brian Kemp's the current Secretary of State, mm-hmm. who is running a very traditional conservative, anti-liberal,
he's running a very grassroots campaign.
Yeah.
He's really reaching out to rural Georgia. He's got a 50-county bus tour. You know, it's a very hand-to-hand retail kind of campaign that Brian's running.
You know, the thing that hit me in looking at the Hill commercial, which I think is a very effective commercial, is that he may be also looking down the road to November when I'm pretty certain that there will be a woman who's nominated by the Democratic Party. And so he's presenting himself as the tough macho guy, where toughness is certainly something we want in a governor. Whether we need somebody who can climb ropes and crawl through mud. Groveling may be involved if you're governor, but I'm not sure that crawling through mud is. And yet he's presenting himself as a I'm the traditional male tough guy in the race.
Kegel strategists, they privately say that there's not really much chance of they're not holding out much hope of winning this outright. But if we're in April and his poll numbers are in the 40s, mid 40s, they have a decision to make whether or not they kind of put it all in. But separately, and you alluded to this earlier when you got Clay Tippins and Hunter Hill mixed up momentarily. Yeah. There's a risk for both those candidates because within days of each other, you have two Atlanta Republicans with military backgrounds and Casey Cagle lookalikes in their commercials.
And two guys who have very little statewide name
recognition. Well, that was the other point I was going to make in going after Casey, is that Casey has enormous name recognition throughout the state. And by taking him on directly, and even Brian in Hunter's ad, then it raises his name ID automatically because then people start talking about it as we are here today, right?
And do Tippins and Hunter Hill kind of cancel each other out, especially with these ads?
That's a really interesting question. And that leads me to what I was going to ask you, Greg. Brian Kemp, you filed a piece this morning. We're in disclosure period now. We've just ended a fundraising period. Brian Kemp did pretty well again. I mean, Cagle is way out front, but Brian Kemp is staying right up there. He is not someone to discount just because Cagle's out raising him right
He's
now.
He's raised nearly $3 million. That's about half of what Cagle's raised. But he has $2 million on hand, so he has enough money to get that message out. And as we talked about earlier, his strategy primarily revolves around rural voters and locking down rural Georgia. And, you know, when you're running against several other candidates who have their bases in metro Atlanta, like Tippins and Hunter Hill, and Michael Williams, who's also a metro Atlanta politician, there's an opening for him just to lock down rural Georgia.
All right. It's going to be fascinating to watch how this unfolds. It is interesting, I think. We've now got more than $10 million. It's more than that now.
Million.
Is it up to 15
yeah, we're
in the
15
governor's
plus.
Race? Amazing. And the fact that we already have two candidates who are buying not just web spots, but are on TV tells you this is going to be an incredibly expensive race and only going to get more and more expensive as the weeks go by, Beth.
It will be, but you can't discount the importance of a grassroots campaign. I of course have to point out that I was involved in Kathy Woolard's race for mayor, where everybody woke up shocked that she'd done so well when we were pretty confident she would do well because it was a classic grassroots campaign. And so I think that that you have to keep an eye on people like Secretary of State Kemp, who if they are running that type of campaign. It's all about identifying your voters and turning them out to vote.
All right. Let's get our second break of the show in because we do want to talk about some national politics that are worth our attention this afternoon. So let's turn to that after we send you to this break.
On the next Fresh Air, Jordan Klepper, host of Comedy Central's The Opposition, a satirical political show in which he delivers commentary in his persona as a far-right conspiracy theorist whose views are in sync with Alex Jones and Breitbart News.
It's all about creating enemies. It's drawing a line. It's them versus us. They hate me, and I am under attack.
Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Greg Bluestein, before we turn to national politics, you were been reporting on what's going on in the Democratic side, the Abrams-Evans race. Give us the latest.
Yeah, I mean, as we get these disclosures today, we're going to see most of these campaigns have most of their money still on hand because a lot of them are conventional strategy of holding as much money as you can, going on air as close as the election as you can. Stacey Abrams will show us a sort of different strategy today. She's raised $2.2 million, but she only has about $450,000 of that left. She spent about 70 to 80% of that money. We don't have the exacts yet, but 70 to 80% of that money already on building out, most of it on building out what Beth was talking about, the grassroots ground game. And it's a very different sort of strategy than your typical approach to campaign.
Well, presumably she's willing to spend that money because she knows, especially as she's nationalized her race and is looking for contributions from around the country, there's no question she's going to be able to raise a lot more money as this election moves forward.
I think it's a pretty safe bet that she'll be raising more money. But I will say this is the second reporting cycle where she will come out having much less money in the bank.
Much less cash on
hand. Yeah, much less cash on hand. I mean, this is the second round.
Yeah.
So if it were one time, that would be one thing. But this is the second time. So, you know, her campaign is going to have to explain that, which is not a place you want to be as a candidate in this stage of the race.
You explain it to donors. What are you doing with your money?
Well, that's where the Greg just memo explained it. Was, right. You know. And, yeah, but she said that the last time, too, that they were building out Ground Game. So, you know, you do build out Ground Game, but you also make sure that you have enough cash on hand to get you through the primary. So she must be banking on raising a whole lot of money.
Beth?
You know, I, again, having just come off of a campaign where we didn't have as much money as other leading candidates did. I'm a firm believer in grassroots campaigns. I think you have to have some money for some air cover, especially for radio in the Democratic case, some TV. But I just think that building out that effort at the ground level and having people who are reaching out and bringing their friends in to support you. Is to me a more effective way to go right now than the traditional campaign.
All right, thank you for sharing all those thoughts with us. We'll obviously be spending a lot more time talking about the governor's race as we move forward. Let's in fact turn, excuse me, to national issues. Real, we can do this quickly. I was interested in the fact that your colleague, Tamar Hallerman, Greg, had an interview with former U.S. Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican, member of the Senate Intel Committee. Saxby told her he doesn't really understand why the heck Republicans on the Hill are picking a fight with FBI and Justice, and he certainly doesn't understand why they were so eager to get these memos out there. It seems to me it's a nice place to be as a retired member of the United States Senate, doesn't have to worry about re-election, and therefore can talk as openly as that about what's going on up there.
And he was very frank about it. He said every organization has a few folks who from time to time need to be called on the carpet. That's what should have been done here, but it should have been done behind closed doors. He raised objections to becoming such a big, huge national outpouring.
All right. I just wanted to make mention of that because I think it is interesting. Let's talk for a couple minutes about the budget deal. We know that a deadline for a spending deadline approaches at midnight tomorrow night. Government runs out of money if we don't have a new bill. We've had continuing resolution after continuing resolution. Nobody likes that. But that's the only way they've been able to continue funding the government. And now, as we said at the top of the show, in the Senate, Democrats and Republicans have agreed to a two-year budget deal that would fund the military at a higher level, would give money to disaster relief, apparently would put money into hospitals like Grady, which have such a disproportionate number of people who cannot pay for their care. It accomplishes a lot, but the immigration piece of it has been stripped, and the House Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi, it's not happy that the leverage has been taken away in terms of doing something about DACA.
And I think what Minority Leader Pelosi is looking for from Speaker Paul Ryan is what Majority Leader McConnell gave to the Democrats in the Senate, which is a promise that he will bring to the floor an immigration bill. Whether or not Speaker Ryan will do that, I don't know. The challenge for Pelosi and the Democrats is that when you're in the minority, you don't really have much leverage. And so the question for Democratic members of the House is going to be whether or not they're willing to go to the mat on DACA, which is an extremely important issue to Democrats in particular, or whether they're willing to go forward, particularly if the Speaker doesn't commit to bringing an immigration bill forward.
Very few people on the Hill want to see the shutdown tomorrow night.
Other than the President.
Well, and the President may want to see it. Let's listen.
If we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill, gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13. There are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of. So we have to strengthen our borders, not by a little bit, but by a lot. We are so far behind the time. And by the way, the world is laughing at us because they can't believe these policies. They don't have it. I could name 15 of them right now. No other country in the world has what we have. And we're going to get it stopped. And if we have to shut it down because the Democrats don't want safety, and unrelated but still related, they don't want to take care of our military, then shut it down.
Beth, I
interrupted
you.
The world is laughing at us for a variety of reasons, which we won't go into here. I think what's really unfortunate coming out of the White House is that on Tuesday, just a week ago, the president talked about bringing us together and finding common ground, et cetera. Yet the language toward immigrants coming out of the White House the past few days has been nothing short of just vitriolic. It's General Kelly, Chief of Staff Kelly, calling some of the Dreamers lazy, too lazy to sign up for DACA. It's the president talking, going back to his killers. I'm surprised you didn't mention rapist. It's not the language that you would expect to hear out of somebody who was truly trying to unify
all right,
us.
So, but here's what's interesting about this, Loretta. It does strike me that Democrats are in a bad place on this. They have to at some point appease their constituents who really want to see DACA extended. They want help for immigration. But the Republicans have put them over a barrel. They already, know that it was a mistake to shut down to be accused of being the ones who shut down the government, whether that was the reality or not. And so here the president comes along and takes them off the hook. That was really strange to me.
Yeah, you can't
your president.
It's hard to justify the rhetoric. I've seen all kinds of very cynical commentaries on the president's, comments about shutting down everything from, this is his way of, factoring in, being the master of the deal, the art of the deal, that, this is a tactic and that all of that. But, in all seriousness, I think that the Congress, particularly the Senate, has demonstrated that enough is enough and that they are going to take the people's business in hand. They've come up with this bipartisan agreement. Neither side is in love with it, but they're both willing to live with it. I think there are enough Republicans also in the House and the Senate that want to see a DACA solution, that is going to come to resolution. But to tie these two things together is not working well for Democrats.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so Nancy Pelosi may complain, but her caucus is not holding together. There are members of her caucus that are going to go along with this. And, to Greg's earlier point, the Speaker's going to need those votes because they're going to be members of the Freedom Caucus that aren't going to go with the numbers here. The numbers are big.
Yeah.
When you're talking about $300 billion, and granted, a large portion of it goes toward military funding and it's a win for, hawks in the Congress, it's still going to be unpalatable to a few people on the margins.
One of the things that Loretta said is most interesting, isn't it, Greg, is that the deal maker is really out of the picture. This is all being negotiated on the Hill, and people, for the most part, the leadership on both sides are saying, don't worry about the president. The president's doing what he does. We're making a deal.
We just heard the president say, I would love to see a shutdown. And now we have a day later, the Senate leaders basically defying him and saying, we don't care what the president says. We're still going to broker this deal. And it looks like the House will follow suit.
Yeah, all right. So we may know by midday tomorrow whether there's going to be a shutdown. But it does appear we're on the way to avoiding a deal and actually having a longer range spending plan. The shoe that still has to drop is, will McConnell make good his promise to have an open debate on the floor about immigration? And will Paul Ryan, who has opposed this forever, be willing to offer that on the House side? We'll see how that plays out in the days ahead.
But we should take a moment to applaud the fact that we actually have some adults
comedy
somewhere.
Comity.
Comity.
With a D.
In the U.S. Senate. Yeah. And we also have the gang of now 20 or 30 who are a bipartisan group of senators who are trying trying to hammer out something on immigration.
That's right.
So there is a little bit of hope for us, those of us who may have given up complete hope on Washington ever functioning properly again.
Absolutely well said. Before we leave you today, if you follow us on Twitter at PoliticsGPB, you will have seen a tweet we put out this morning, a link to a column by Dana Milbank. He writes, of course, for the Washington Post. And we just thought it was worth mentioning on Twitter and then talking about briefly because it is very, very funny. This kind of plays on the president the other day, talking about all the standing ovations he gets, how much people love applauding him. Milbank proposes this. He suggests that people who denounce President Trump, who don't like Trump's antics, could take a simple step that would prevent him from being quite as outrageous. He suggests the formation of an organization called AmeriClaps, which would give Americans the opportunity to volunteer to applaud for President Trump. And there are various levels at which you can join this. You can join, for instance, at the lowest level, the Putin level. AmeriClaps people at the Putin level would have to applaud for the president 60 minutes a year. You can go all the way up to the cabinet level, or you can go as far as the Orrin Hatch level. You've got to commit 52 hours a year of applause, an hour a week, and praise in fawning praise of the President of the United States. The point is, it's really a funny column. Whether you're a Trump fan or not a Trump fan, we're going to post it on our website. And if you want to read it, you really ought to.
I suspect it's funnier to people who are not Trump fans than to people who are Trump fans.
Could be.
And I guess the other question is, would the president be disqualified from participating because he was applauding himself during the State of the Union address last week?
All right. Enough said on that. We're out of time for today's show. Beth Shapiro, pleasure to have you here. Loretta Lepore, thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Greg Bluestein, what do you got for us tomorrow? Give us one byline that we'll see viewers tomorrow.
I'll have a deeper story about Stacey Abrams' ground game because I kind of anticipated that she'd be spending so much money on it. So I went out with her campaign staff a couple Saturdays ago and spent the day with them.
Okay, where'd you go?
We went all over East Atlanta. I watched as they knocked on probably 50, 60 doors.
All right, so we'll see that in tomorrow's edition of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Remember, Greg also files for the Political Insider blog, which is part of Politically Georgia, which is also part of myajc.com. So you can follow him there. That's about it for us today. As I said earlier, we're going to hit the road tomorrow morning, head down to Savannah. Really looking forward to seeing all of you down there. We've gotten so many really nice notes from people who've said they're going to be at the show, and we're looking forward to getting a chance to meet you. We'll broadcast that show Friday at 2. I'll be here tomorrow at 2 with a two-way street, and I hope you'll join us for that show as well. In the meantime, take care. We'll see you again tomorrow for Two-Way Street.